So think about the 1700s for a second. Just picture it. To you listening right now, it probably feels like, I don't know, ancient history.
Oh, absolutely. Think of powdered wigs, wooden ships.
Exactly. The dawn of the Industrial Revolution. It just feels impossibly distant. But what if I told you that you're only about six people away from the year 1700?
See, that is, it's the ultimate perspective shift, really. When you map history by generations rather than by centuries, the compression of time is just staggering.
It really is. I mean, the author of our source material points out something that completely, shattered my concept of history. Their grandmother lived in the 1800s.
Right, just two generations ago.
Exactly. Just two. And her grandparents, who she likely knew, and spoke to, they were alive in the 1700s.
Which is wild to think about.
Right. And their grandparents were alive at the very beginning of the 1700s. So we're literally only about six lifetimes like, six people sitting in a room talking to each other, passing down stories away from the dawn of the modern industrial era.
And if you go back just, what, five more generations, you're deep in the 1600s.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing.
It is. And it means the modern world is not the result of, millions of years of gradual linear progression. We didn't just slowly climb this sturdy ladder from caveman to astronaut.
Right, it wasn't just a slow walk.
Exactly. We're looking at an explosion, a highly compressed, incredibly violent explosion of coevolution.
And honestly, that is the mission of our deep dive today. We're going to explore how humanity co-evolved with technology over these incredibly brief lifetimes.
Yeah.
We're going to track how we went from naive observation, basically just looking at the world and making guesses about how it worked, to building the incredibly complex control systems that now rule our physical, our biological, and our social worlds.
Because humanity didn't just walk forward, we experienced what the sources call three simultaneous cognitive expansions.
Right. So we expanded our understanding outward into the massive physical
So that's,
macroverse.
yeah.
Yes. And inward into the invisible microverse. And then abstractly into the social and narrative space.
Yeah.
And this all happened at the exact same time.
Which is key. And if you're listening and looking for like an analytical lens to view all of this through, it's the concept of feedback loop.
Feedback loops, right?
Yeah, this isn't just a catalog of neat inventions. It's a story about interconnectivity. So science built better tools, right?
Yeah.
And those tools allowed us to observe smaller things.
Like germs and atoms.
Exactly. And observing smaller things improved our underlying science. That science then improved our manufacturing processes, which generated entirely new societal
Which we
problems.
will definitely get
Oh,
into.
we will. And those problems required new science to solve. So every single expansion fed the others in this accelerating loop.
Okay, so to really understand the world that you, the listener, are sitting in right now, we have to start by looking outward. Because before we could automate the world, we basically had to figure out how to physically manipulate it, right? We had to amplify human physical power.
Right. And civil and military engineering are essentially the foundational building blocks of that macroverse.
And the roots of this physical manipulation go super deep. I mean, the text brings up Jericho, which is a walled city built, what, 6,000 years ago?
Around then, yes.
But where it gets really granular and really interesting to me is with the Romans. Because we always hear about Roman aqueducts, right?
Sure, the big stone arches.
Right. But the engineering mechanism behind them is so brilliant. They weren't just building these downward sloping troughs. They actually utilized inverted siphons to push water through valleys.
Which is a massive leap in fluid dynamics.
It really is. Like water would flow down into a sealed pipe in a valley, and the pressure of the water behind it would basically force it back up the other side so it could continue its journey.
Yeah, they were manipulating fluid dynamics and pressure systems way, way before they had the physics equations to actually explain why it worked.
Exactly. It was just practical engineering. And what really blew my mind was the Roman army itself.
Oh, it's a fascinating organizational structure.
Every single soldier was expected to be a functioning engineer.
Yeah.
They could be on this grueling march all day, stop for the night, and in just like 3 to 4 hours, construct a perfectly square, fortified camp with a rampart, a ditch, a palisade. The works.
Right. It wasn't just a military force. It was essentially a highly mobile construction company.
A heavily armed construction company, yeah.
But here is the critical distinction we have to make. For thousands of years, this engineering was largely experimental.
Right, trial and error.
Exactly. It was based on heuristics, trial and error, and just passed down institutional knowledge. It was not based on formal mathematical modeling.
Yeah, they weren't sitting down doing calculus.
No, not at all. In fact, civil engineering didn't even become a recognized non-military profession until much, much later. The milestone the source material points to is the 1828 Royal Charter in London.
Which formally defined it, right?
Yes, it defines civil engineering as, quote, directing the great sources of power in nature for the use and convenience of man.
Okay, let's unpack that transition for a second. Going from simple tools to directing the, quote, great sources of power. Because if we're looking for the absolute tipping point where human power tools evolved into the modern era of mechanical engineering, the text gives us a truly unexpected marker.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
It's so good.
Yeah.
The year is 1584. The inventor is Sir John Harrington. And the invention is the toilet.
Your water closet.
Yes, the water closet.
It inevitably gets a laugh, right?
Yeah.
But analytically, it is a profound technological milestone.
I mean, I have to admit, I pushed back on this at first when I was reading it. I was like, why is a toilet the dawn of modern mechanical engineering? It's literally just a bucket with water, right?
That's the common misconception, yeah.
But then I looked at the actual mechanism that Harrington designed. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a bucket. It had a pan with an opening that was sealed by a leather-faced valve. And it used this whole system of handles, levers, and weights. When you pulled the handle, water would pour from a cistern while the weight simultaneously shifted to open the valve. It's essentially an early physical algorithm.
Yes, that's the perfect way to describe it.
It's a mechanical if-then statement, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you pull the handle, then the weight shifts, the valve opens, the water flows, and then the weights reset the whole system.
And that resetting is the crucial element here. You've identified the exact shift. You are moving from a simple tool, like a shovel or a bucket or a hammer, which requires continuous human energy to operate.
Right, you have to keep swinging the hammer.
Exactly. You move from that to an autonomous control system. This toilet had a rudimentary feedback mechanism. It managed fluid dynamics, physical pressure, and mechanical force without a human having to manually regulate every single step of the process.
You just pull the handle and walk away?
Precisely. And once you grasp the concept of an automated mechanical control system, you can scale it. That specific underlying logic, using mechanical components to regulate a process, is the exact same logic that eventually scales up to massive automated manufacturing plants.
So you take these self-regulating mechanical systems and you hook them up to a limitless power source, like steam.
Yes.
And when you do that, you don't just change how a factory works. You send a complete shockwave through the entire fabric of human society.
The transition from biological power to steam power is the great accelerator, because human and animal muscle power is severely limited by biology,
right,
and by location.
Yeah, you have to rest.
You have to rest, you have to eat, you have to be near a river if you're using a water wheel, but steam power. You can place that anywhere, and it operates relentlessly, 24/7.
And the velocity of this change, it's just really hard to wrap your head around. Let's look at the mechanisms of the textile industry, for example. Mm-hmm. Before this, you had, you know, one person sitting in a cottage with a spinning wheel turning raw cotton into yarn.
Very slow, very manual.
Very slow. But by mechanizing the cotton spinning process and attaching it to steam power, productivity didn't just double. It increased by a factor of 500.
Something unbelievable.
500. And then automatic weaving increased productivity by a factor of 40. So you go from a single person spinning yarn to a massive factory churning out miles of fabric in a single day.
Right.
But, and here's the catch to staff, those massive factories, you completely upend where human beings actually live.
The demographic shift is definitely the most visible indicator of the societal shockwave. I mean, let's just look at the data. In the year 1600, only about 5% of the global population lived in urban areas.
Just 5%.
Just 5%. But by the year 2000, that number had skyrocketed to nearly 50%.
Wow.
And in specific regions like North America, it went from 1% to 79%.
That is a total restructuring of human existence.
It is. And we have to ask why this matters sociologically. Cramming millions of human beings into incredibly tight geographic spaces creates a completely new narrative in social space. It necessitates entirely new forms of governance, new infrastructure, and unfortunately, entirely new categories of suffering.
Right. And actually, I want to pause here on the concept of the Malthusian trap, because the source material mentions that industrialization broke it. But I think we need to explain what that actually meant for the average person living through this.
Certainly. So Thomas Malthus was an economist who essentially theorized that human population grows exponentially, but food production only grows arithmetically.
So people outbreed the food supply.
Exactly. So historically, anytime a society experienced a period of prosperity and the population grew, they would inevitably run out of food. The abundance would lead directly to starvation, disease, and a massive population crash. It was this brutal, unavoidable cycle.
So the nature correcting the balance.
Yes. But industrialization allowed us to produce resources, including mechanized agriculture, fast enough to actually outpace that exponential population growth.
So we outran the trap.
We did. For the first time in recorded history, population and average income were rising simultaneously.
But the growing pains of breaking that trap were absolutely horrifying.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the housing and the infrastructure of these cities couldn't remotely keep up with the massive influx of people. We are talking about horrific slums here.
Oh, truly dreadful conditions.
Dirt floors, families, like, crammed into single rooms. In mid-1800s France, the sheer density and squalor caused the average life expectancy to drop to 35 years old.
35. Think about that.
It's tragic. You had brutal 14-hour factory shifts for children. And perhaps the most pressing mechanical failure of this whole urban experiment was the water.
Because the macro engineering of the cities had completely outpaced the sanitary engineering.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Because there were no complex sewage systems yet, human waste was just dumped into cesspits.
Right.
And those cesspits seeped straight into the ground, directly contaminating the public drinking water wells, which, as you can guess, leads to massive cholera outbreaks.
Yeah.
And the story of the 1854 Broad Street cholera outbreak in London is such a perfect example of this, of observation evolving into control. So you have this physician named John Snow. And at the time, everyone thought cholera was spread by miasma.
Miasma, yes. Which basically just meant bad air.
Right, bad smells in the air. But Snow doesn't just guess or accept that. He maps it. He takes a physical map of the Soho district and literally draws a dot for every single cholera death.
It's a very early, very brilliant application of spatial data analysis.
It really is. And he realizes that all the dots are clustered heavily around one specific public water pump on Broad Street.
Hmm.
So he investigates and he finds a leaking cesspit just feet away from the pump's well.
And this is where the control system comes in.
Exactly. He takes his data to the local council, and what does he do? He doesn't invent a magical cure for cholera. He just has them remove the handle from the water pump so people can't use it.
So simple.
So simple. And the outbreak drops off almost immediately. It is literally the birth of modern epidemiology, driven by the sheer necessity of surviving these new urban environments.
And analytically speaking, we have to view the social and political movements of this era through that exact same lens of pressure and response.
How do you mean?
Well, just as an engineer builds a mechanical relief valve to prevent a steam engine from exploding, right? Society generates its own relief mechanisms when the human pressure builds too high.
Okay. Right, so you have people working these grueling 14-hour days, watching their children die from tainted water, all while the factory owners are accumulating unprecedented massive wealth. So naturally, the society starts to push back.
Exactly.
And this is where we see figures like Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels looking at the sheer squalor of places like Manchester and London. And they start writing about class struggle and how the owners of the means of production are extracting value from the laborers.
And keeping our impartial lens here, it's important to understand that Marxist theories, alongside other movements like the Luddite rebellions, where textile workers were literally smashing the automated looms that were displacing their labor.
Right. The original machine breakers.
Exactly. Or the Chartist movement demanding political equality.
Yeah.
These were not isolated political events occurring in a vacuum. They were direct, reactive social feedback mechanisms.
Right, they were a response to the environment.
Yes. The socioeconomic engine was identifying what it perceived as a fatal flaw in its operation, extreme wealth inequality, and human degradation. And it was generating a response to force a rebalancing of the system.
And as that system struggled to rebalance itself, this highly volatile engine of mass production was also generating something entirely new. The middle class.
Yes, a very profound shift.
Because factories were producing goods so cheaply now, everyday people suddenly had disposable income.
It's the democratization of luxury goods.
Which gives birth to modern consumerism.
Mm-hmm.
And the milestones here are just wild to me. You get the first department store at 1796. the whole concept of window shopping is invented because glass manufacturing finally gets cheap enough to make massive display windows.
You couldn't window shop before then because there were no large windows.
Right. And you get entirely new industries built purely on leisure. Like, case in point. In 1868, Cadbury creates the first Valentine's Day heart-shaped chocolate box.
Laughs.
I mean, think about that trajectory for a second.
Okay.
You go from living in a rural cottage, constantly at the edge of starvation, to buying heart-shaped chocolates in a massive glass-fronted department store, all within a few generations.
It perfectly encapsulates the duality of the macro expansion. Vast systemic suffering running parallel to unprecedented material wealth. But to truly understand how humanity survived this urban crowding, how we didn't just collapse under the weight of cholera and disease, we have to look away from the massive factories.
Right.
We have to look down into the invisible.
The filth of the city necessitated looking closer. Which brings us to the second cognitive expansion, the microverse. Because while steam engines were reshaping cities above ground, an equally powerful revolution was happening completely out of sight. You can't truly master the macro world until you understand the micro world.
Absolutely. The ability to physically see the invisible fundamentally altered the human survival equation. I mean, before the microscope, you couldn't fight an enemy you couldn't see.
Right, you're just swinging in the dark.
Precisely. Diseases were attributed to divine retribution, or as you mentioned earlier, miasma.
But the timeline of discovering this invisible world is breathtaking. So in the 1590s, the first compound microscope is invented by Dutch spectacle makers. They literally just put two lenses in a tube and realize they can magnify objects.
A simple mechanical arrangement.
Yeah. And then by 1665, Robert Hooke is looking at cork and identifies these tiny walled structures he calls cells. By 1683, Antony van Leeuwenhoek is looking at dental plaque growths, but true in seeing living, moving bacteria.
He called them animalcules.
Yes. And then by 1796, Edward Jenner develops the first modern smallpox vaccine. I mean, think about the speed of that. We went from literally not knowing bacteria existed to programming the human immune system to fight a specific virus in just over a century.
And the ultimate impact of this microscopic expansion is arguably the greatest achievement in the history of our species. Average global lifespans effectively doubled.
Doubled.
Yes. We went from an average life expectancy of around 30 years to roughly 60 years over the course of just a century and a half.
Let's talk about what that actually means for a civilization. Because when you double a lifespan, you aren't just giving people more time to, like, relax on the porch.
Oh, not at all. It creates a powerful, virtuous cycle of knowledge. When people live longer, they can acquire significantly more education. They can work in specialized, highly technical fields for decades rather than just a few years. They can actively mentor the next generation. Doubling the lifespan dramatically accelerated the pace of scientific discovery because the great minds of the era simply had more time to think, experiment, run failed trials, and collaborate before they died.
But knowing the science, like knowing that a vaccine works, is only half the battle, right?
Right.
You also have to engineer the physical delivery system. The sources highlight the vaccine cold chain. And it is this fascinating logistical puzzle.
It really is.
Because to vaccinate millions of people across a continent, you can't just have one smart doctor in a lab. You need a perfect symphony of industrial processes.
It's the fusion of the biological and the mechanical.
Right. You need massive fermentation vats with precise temperature and pressure controls to cultivate the vaccine in bulk. Then, because vaccines degrade rapidly if they get warm, you need industrial refrigeration.
Which was incredibly difficult at the time.
Yeah. You need rapid transportation trains and steamships to move it before it spoils. You need deep chemical understanding to ensure the purity of the glass vials holding it. The medical miracle of the microverse was completely dependent on the heavy macro engineering we just talked about.
It's all connected, but to achieve that level of control over temperature, chemistry, and pressure, scientists had to understand the fundamental rules of the universe at an even smaller scale than bacteria.
Right. They had to go deeper.
They had to understand the nature of matter itself. They had to interrogate physics.
Which leads to one of the most incredible philosophical and scientific debates in history.
Yeah.
The existence of the vacuum.
Ah, yes.
So in 1643, a physicist named Evangelista Torricelli conducts this brilliantly simple experiment. Picture this. He takes a long glass tube closed at one end and fills it to the brim with liquid mercury. He puts his thumb over the open end, turns it upside down, and submerges it into a basin. Wait, what was the basin filled with?
More mercury.
Right, a basin filled with more mercury. So when he removes his thumb, The mercury in the tube drops, but it doesn't empty out entirely. It stops, leaving an empty space at the very top of the sealed tube.
And this simple physical demonstration challenged thousands of years of Aristotelian dogma.
How so?
Well, the prevailing philosophical belief for centuries was that nature abhors a vacuum. The idea was that true nothingness was an impossibility in the universe. Something would always rush in to fill a void.
But Torricelli proved two massive concepts at once here. First, he proved that the atmosphere, the air all around us, actually has weight.
Yes.
There's the weight of the air pushing down on the mercury in the basin that held the column of mercury up inside the tube.
Right? Exactly. Atmospheric pressure.
And second, he proved that the space at the top of the tube was empty. A vacuum. Air couldn't get in to fill it.
Although, if we follow the progression of the source material into the 20th century, we find that the Aristotelians were, in a very bizarre, quantum mechanical way, slightly right.
I am so glad you brought this up because I was completely stuck on this part of the research. How can scientists ever prove that nothingness actually exists?
It's a tricky concept.
It really is. The text dives into Paul Dirac and quantum physics, noting that the Dirac equation suggests that empty space is never truly empty. It describes a quantum vacuum where empty space is actually boiling with spontaneous electron and anti-electron generation.
Yes, quantum fluctuations.
Right, these virtual particles pop into existence and instantly recombine and annihilate each other, almost like static on an old television screen. Plus, you have electromagnetic waves and gravity constantly passing through this space. So I have to ask you, is there ever really a true, pure vacuum?
From a strict quantum mechanical perspective, no. The void is always humming with latent energy. And here is the piece that usually gets overlooked when we get bogged down in quantum philosophy. Whether or not it's a perfect quantum vacuum is irrelevant to the engineering.
Oh, interesting. Why?
Because the mechanical ability to remove atmospheric gases like oxygen and nitrogen from a sealed environment was revolutionary in itself.
Since it stops chemical reactions.
Exactly. Removing oxygen prevents oxidation. It prevents burning. And that specific capability creating a practical mechanical vacuum directly led to the invention of vacuum tubes.
Right.
If you put a filament in a glass bulb and run electricity through it, it will catch fire and burn out instantly if there is oxygen present. But if you pump the air out and create a vacuum, it glows.
It becomes a light bulb.
Yes. The attempt to study nothingness gave us the incandescent light bulb. And those vacuum tubes evolved into the foundational technology for X-ray machines, radio signal amplification, and the cathode ray tubes that powered early televisions. Manipulating the void basically gave us the modern electronic world.
That is incredible. And once scientists could isolate these elements, you know, once they could see the invisible rules of chemistry and manipulate the environment, they stopped just foraging for natural materials. They started engineering reality from the atomic level up.
This is what we call the materials paradigm.
Right.
For the vast majority of human history, if you wanted to build something, a wheel, a ship, a weapon, you had to find a material in nature that suited your needs. You cut down a tree, you mined iron, you sheared a sheep. You were completely constrained by what the earth naturally provided.
You had to work with what you had.
Exactly. But once we understood atomic structure, we flipped the script. We decided what structural properties we needed first, and then we invented the material to match it.
The story of Charles Goodyear in 1839 is the perfect example of this. Natural rubber existed, but it was basically useless for industry. I mean, in the summer heat, a rubber raincoat would melt into this sticky goo, and in the winter, it froze and shattered like glass.
Not very practical.
Not at all. And Goodyear was obsessed with fixing this to the point where he literally went to debtor's prison. The breakthrough finally happened when he accidentally dropped a mixture of rubber and sulfur onto a hot stove. It charred, but it didn't melt.
And if we look at the mechanism of why that worked, it's a masterclass in atomic manipulation. Raw rubber is made of long polymer chains that slide past each other easily, kind of like a bowl of wet noodles.
Okay, wet noodles. Got it.
That's why it melts. But when Goodyear added sulfur and heat, the sulfur atoms created chemical bridges between those polymer chains, locking them together like a chain link fence. That process, vulcanization, allowed rubber to maintain its elasticity while resisting extreme temperature changes.
Which gave us the tires that allowed automobiles to actually function. And the timeline just accelerates from there. In 1909, Leo Baekeland invents Bakelite, which is the first commercially successful synthetic plastic. It doesn't conduct electricity, and it's heat-resistant, making it perfect for insulating the new electrical grids. Then you get Pyrex in 1924.
Now, Pyrex is a brilliant example of engineering a specific atomic property, the thermal expansion coefficient.
Which means what exactly?
Well, regular glass expands when it gets hot and shrinks when it cools. If that happens too fast, the stress causes it to shatter.
Like pouring boiling water into a cold glass.
Exactly. But by adding boron to the glass mixture to create borosilicate glass, scientists fundamentally changed how the atoms vibrate and distance themselves from each other under heat. You engineered a material that can go directly from a hot oven into cold water without shattering.
And then you have nylon in 1931, completely replacing silk with synthesized polymers. You just must have these engineered materials to build the complex control systems of the modern world. I mean, think about the requirements for a modern spacesuit.
Oh, they're intensely demanding.
Right. It has to isolate an astronaut thermally from absolute zero in the shadows to extreme heat in the sun. It has to remain perfectly flexible in a vacuum. It has to stop micrometeoroids traveling at thousands of miles an hour. It has to hold a pressurized oxygen seal and resist chemical degradation.
There is no single natural material on Earth that can do all that.
Exactly. You have to weave together multiple layers of engineered atoms. Or consider a nuclear turbine blade. It has to withstand 950 degrees Celsius while rotating at 3,600 revolutions per minute in a highly radioactive environment for decades without warping even a millimeter.
That requires manipulating crystal structures at the microscopic level to achieve macroscopic stability.
And while we were mastering the atom, we were simultaneously mastering the electron. Which brings us to the ultimate collapse of physical distance.
Yes. The timeline of electrical engineering is explosive. You go from Alessandro Volta inventing the first chemical battery in 1800, which finally gave humanity portable, stored power that wasn't, you know, on fire.
Right.
To the telegraph just a few decades later. And the telegraph is the critical inflection point for human communication. It represents a complete phase transition in the velocity of information.
Let's really emphasize this because the sheer scale of the speed increase is hard to internalize. Think about the speed of communication before electricity. For all of recorded human history, information could only move as fast as a biological entity could carry it. A horse running, a ship sailing.
Very slow.
At absolute best, if you were shouting or using a loud horn, information moved at the speed of sound. That is roughly 300 meters per second. But the telegraph uses electromagnetic waves. It moves information along a copper wire at the speed of light.
Yes.
That is 300 million meters per second. That is a million-fold increase in velocity. If you apply that million-fold increase to human movement, it is the equivalent of going from walking down the street to instantaneous teleportation.
That analogy perfectly captures the magnitude of the shift. The physical constraints of geography were suddenly rendered completely irrelevant to the flow of information. I mean, in 1866, the transatlantic telegraph cable is successfully laid across the ocean floor. And suddenly, the financial markets and governments of Europe and North America are communicating with an end-to-end delay of 0.02 seconds.
It's basically real time. The Queen of England can send a message to the President of the United States faster than she could shout across a courtyard.
It is real time. And the technology scales from point-to-point communication to mass broadcasting incredibly rapidly. By 1920, you have the launch of KDKA, the first commercial radio station in Pittsburgh, broadcasting the presidential election results.
Whoa, 1920.
And the implication of this is massive global synchronization. Prior to this, humanity existed in isolated pockets of knowledge. News of a war ending or a king dying took months to cross an ocean. People lived in different narrative realities based on their geography.
They were just disconnected.
Completely. But with radio, millions of people are suddenly hearing the exact same information delivered with the exact same emotional inflection at the exact same time. We transitioned into a real-time, globally shared narrative space.
And as KDKA radio was broadcasting out to those millions of listeners, science started to turn its new, highly precise, statistically driven lens onto the listeners themselves.
Yes.
We had mastered the macroverse of engineering and cities. We had mastered the microverse of atoms, germs, and electrons. Now, humanity attempted the third cognitive expansion, measuring and modeling the human mind in society.
The narrative expansion. This is where the scientific method, which had been so incredibly successful with physical materials like rubber and glass, is applied to the deeply abstract concepts of human thought and social behavior.
The shift in psychology is dramatic. I mean, for thousands of years, mental illness and behavioral anomalies were treated with mysticism or just sheer brutality. The source material mentions treatments ranging from exorcisms to leeches to bleeding patients to literally tying them to mattresses suspended from the ceiling to spin them around.
All right.
Yeah. But in 1848, a gruesome accident changes everything. A railroad foreman named Phineas Gage is working in Vermont. He's using a 3-foot-long heavy iron rod to tamp explosive powder into a rock. The powder ignites prematurely.
Right.
The iron rod shoots upward like a missile, enters under his left cheekbone, passes completely behind his left eye, and explodes out through the top of his skull, landing 80 feet away.
It's a catastrophic brain injury. Survival should have been impossible.
Yet, amazingly, Gage froze his brow, sits up, and is speaking within minutes.
Incredible.
He rides in an ox cart back to town, sits on the porch of a hotel, and when the doctor arrives, Gage points to the hole in his head and says, "Here is business enough for you."
Such a calm reaction to such trauma.
He physically survives, and his intellect and memory remain largely intact. But his personality completely flips. Before the accident, he was known as a shrewd, responsible, even-tempered businessman. Afterward, he became impulsive, profane, erratic, and unable to stick to plans. His friend said he was no longer Gage.
And the medical community's reaction to Gage provided biological proof that the brain is not just a homogeneous blob of tissue. It proved that specific brain functions, particularly executive function, social inhibition, and personality, are localized in specific physical areas of the brain, like the frontal lobe.
It anchored the ethereal concept of the soul, or personality, firmly into physical biology. And it paved the way for psychology to evolve.
Yes, it did.
You see, Wilhelm Wundt opened the first experimental psychology lab in 1879, moving the discipline out of philosophy departments. Then you have the rapid evolution of theories from Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung exploring the subconscious drives to the behaviorists like Ivan Pavlov and B.F. Skinner, who studied how living creatures can be conditioned to respond to stimuli.
But there is a fundamental friction here when comparing the social sciences to the physical science.
Actually, I was just going to ask about that. How could psychology ever truly become a hard science?
Yeah.
Human behavior is notoriously unpredictable. Like, if I hold a glass out and drop it, gravity pulls it down the exact same way every single time.
Right, that's Newtonian physics.
But if I expose 10 different people to the exact same psychological stimulus, say, a loud noise or a complex puzzle, I might get 10 completely different emotional or behavioral reactions. You can't perfectly reproduce a human experiment.
And that is the core challenge of the social sciences. You cannot isolate a human being in a vacuum tube. You cannot eliminate all confounding variables, their upbringing, their genetics, what they had for breakfast, when studying their behavior.
So how do they handle it?
The mechanism they developed to solve this problem was the introduction of advanced statistics and psychometrics in the early 1900s. Since an individual human experiment cannot be perfectly reproduced, like a chemical reaction, statistics became the essential tool to infer causality.
Meaning they stop looking at the individual and start looking at the crowd.
Exactly. Statistics allowed psychologists to identify average behaviors across large populations and measure deviations from those averages with mathematical precision. You might not be able to predict exactly what one specific person will do, but you can predict with a high degree of certainty what a population of 10,000 people will do on average. You find correlation through mass data, even if individual behavior remains highly variable.
And that exact same statistical data-driven approach was being applied on an even grander scale to entire civilizations, mapping the birth of sociology. The text traces the roots of proto-sociology all the way back to the 14th century with the Islamic scholar Ibn Khaldun.
A brilliant thinker.
He wasn't just writing history. He was studying the dynamics of tribal cohesion. He looked at how empires rise and fall based on psychological and economic factors, creating models of societal life cycles. Later, you have Enlightenment thinkers like Jean-Jacques Rousseau writing The Social Contract, analytically trying to figure out how to establish legitimate political authority without crushing individual freedom.
But the transition into a true data-backed science crystallizes with figures like Emile Durkheim in the late 1890s.
Tell us about him.
Durkheim's study of suicide is a landmark moment. He didn't look at suicide as an individual moral failing or a purely psychological breakdown. He used empirical data to study suicide rates across different religious and national populations, looking for societal patterns.
And what did you find?
He demonstrated that social integration, how connected an individual feels to their community, directly impacted suicide rates. He used statistics to prove that society exerts an invisible, measurable force on the individual.
which requires a profound shift in how we think about science itself.
It does. All of this modeling, whether it is in psychology, sociology, or even advanced physics, relies on a formalized philosophy of science. The fundamental premise of the scientific method is causality. The basic formula is that a specific cause, acting through a specific mechanism, produces a specific effect.
Cause, mechanism, effect. Yeah. Got it.
Exactly. But how do you know if your theory about that mechanism is actually right? How do you prevent science from just becoming a series of highly educated guesses?
Right, because you can just guess mechanisms all day long.
Exactly. The philosopher Karl Popper formalized the answer with the concept of refutability or falsifiability.
Right, the black swan analogy.
Precisely. If your theory is that all swans are white, you cannot prove it true just by observing 1,000 white swans. There might always be a black swan you haven't seen yet.
Right.
To be scientifically valid, your theory must be testable in a way that actively tries to prove it false. You have to go looking for the black swan. Science isn't actually about proving things true. It is about proposing testable theories that continuously withstand rigorous, brutal attempts to prove them false. If a theory survives every experiment designed to break it, we accept it as our working model of reality.
Until, of course, a better theory comes along that explains more anomalies.
And
so sociology and psychology were building these intricate statistical models trying to measure and predict the human narrative. Mm-hmm. But the text makes a fascinating pivot here. Because while science was trying to measure the narrative, the arts have always been the most effective tool to control and shape it.
The arts, and particularly music, represent a completely different type of control system. We've talked about mechanical systems using weights and valves, and electrical systems using copper wires. Music is a control system that operates directly on human emotion and social cohesion.
What's wild is how early humans tried to engineer music mechanically, kind of blending the macro engineering with the arts.
Mm.
We go all the way back to the 9th century in Baghdad, and the text highlights the Banu Musa brothers.
Yes.
There were scholars who invented an automatic flute player. It used a pinned barrel mechanism, basically a rotating cylinder with pins stuck in it that would trigger levers to play notes, much like a large music box. It's essentially the first programmable machine in history.
A beautiful piece of early engineering.
Yeah. Then leap forward to 1737, and you have Jacques de Vaucanson in France. He builds a life-size mechanical Shepard automaton that plays the flute. It wasn't just a speaker playing a record. The machine actually breathed air from artificial lungs. And because stiff metal fingers couldn't create a perfect seal over the holes on the wooden flute, Vaucanson literally gloved the machine's hands in pliable skin to make it work.
It's the ultimate physical fusion of engineering and art. But beyond the mechanics of physically playing music, the actual composition of music was deeply influenced by the scientific era.
How so?
If you look at classical music, particularly during the Enlightenment with composers like Bach and Beethoven, it evolved into a highly structured, almost mathematical discipline.
Ugh.
The source material mentions homophonic structures and clear tonal resolutions. To put that simply, homophony is when you have one clear dominant melody supported by a structured harmony of chords. It is orderly, it has rules, it resolves logically.
So it's predictable.
Yes. The music of this era reflected the order, hierarchy, and rationalism of Newtonian physics. It was an auditory representation of a well-ordered, predictable universe.
But the true lasting power of music isn't just its mathematical structure. It's its capacity for emotional hacking. The philosophers understood this centuries before we had MRIs to watch the brain light up. Plato wrote extensively that music imitates emotions, courage, moderation, sorrow, and that it should be used for the ethical education of citizens because it basically shapes the soul.
It's a profound thought.
Yeah. René Descartes wrote The Passions of the Soul, arguing that music physically stirs the animal spirits in our bodies to produce joy or sadness. They understood that music is a direct, unfiltered pipeline to human emotion.
Which is precisely why music has been utilized throughout history as a primary narrative control system. It is wielded both by those in institutional power and by those resisting that power.
The history of protest music laid out in the sources perfectly illustrates this constant tug of war. Let's look at how emotions are hacked by both sides. Take the song Yankee Doodle. Originally, British soldiers sang it to mock and insult the American colonists. The lyrics were designed to paint the Americans as backwoods, unsophisticated simpletons.
Right.
But what did the Americans do? They completely co-opted the tune. They took the insult, flipped the narrative, and sang it as they marched into battle. They turned a psychological weapon into an anthem of patriotic pride.
a brilliant re-engineering of the narrative space.
Or look at the labor movements during that brutal industrialization we talked about earlier. You have songs like Solidarity Forever, which was used to unify striking workers across different languages and backgrounds.
Yeah.
Or Woody Guthrie's This Land Is Your Land. Most people learned the chorus in elementary school, but the original lyrics were a sharp protest against the economic disparities of the time, featuring highly critical verses about private property signs and people waiting in hunger lines in the shadow of massive wealth.
If we look at this sociologically, music is perhaps the ultimate societal control system. Think about how a simple melody bypasses our logical critical filters. It doesn't require a complex philosophical argument.
You don't have to think about it.
No, you don't. It doesn't require a statistical chart to prove its point. It instantly creates a shared emotional state. When thousands of people sing the exact same song, breathing at the same time, hitting the same notes, it generates spontaneous social cohesion. It creates a sense of shared morality and unifies the action of the group. It aligns the narrative space of a massive group of individuals faster and more effectively than any speech ever could.
So what does this all mean for us? We started this deep dive by talking about human history not as a sturdy linear ladder, but as a compressed, violent explosion.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at the world around you right now, the smartphone or device you are listening to this on,
mm-hmm.
the highly engineered temperature-controlled medicines in your cabinet, the sheer towering density of the city you might be sitting in, it is all the direct cascading result of these three simultaneous cognitive expansions. We expanded physically outward by mastering mechanical and electrical engineering. We expanded invisibly inward by mapping the microverse of atoms, thermodynamics, and germs. And we expanded psychologically by utilizing statistics to model human behavior and wielding media to synchronize our global narratives. They all co-evolved, constantly feeding into each other in an endless, accelerating loop of progress.
It is a remarkable testament to human ingenuity and our drive to control our environment. But it also leaves us with an incredibly important and perhaps unsettling question, one that builds directly on the trajectory of the source material we've explored today.
What's that?
Well, over the last few centuries, we have successfully mapped the macroscopic world of civil engineering. We have mapped the microscopic world of quantum mechanics, and we have built complex statistical models to understand human behavior. But today, we are introducing a new variable. Yes, as artificial intelligence and highly complex algorithms begin to drive our cultural, political, and social narratives at a speed and scale that is faster than human biology can even comprehend, are we on the verge of a fourth cognitive expansion? One where the automated control systems we originally built to serve us begin expanding their own cognitive space, operating independently in the narrative realm without us.
Now that is a thought to keep you up at night. The ladder is definitely gone, and the explosion is still happening all around us. Thank you to you, our listener, for joining us on this deep dive into the source material. We hope you walk away looking at the engineered concrete world around you, the invisible world sustaining your biology, and even the music you listen to on your commute, with a completely new perspective.